RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the Tennis with an Accent podcast. I am Matt Zemek. We are coming on the air a little bit late this week. That's because Saqib, my partner, hasn't been feeling great. We wanted to get him into 100% playing shape because, as Roger Federer believes, if you're fit to play, you got to take the court. But we don't want Saqib to take the court if he's ill, so we want him to get back to 100%. So I am taking care of the podcast this week, and I am very pleased to have as our guest Skip Schwartzman. First, a brief introduction. If you've been reading us at tennisaccent.com, you might have noticed during the ATP finals in London that Skip filed a few dispatches for Tennis with an Accent. He was inside the O2 Arena. He saw a few sessions. He commented on singles, doubles, the quality of the kits, and everything in between. And another personal word about Skip, he is part of Peter Botto's Tennis World community. It's a community a decade ago where myself and Tennis with an Accent contributor Andrew Burton and many other famous alums such as New Balls Please, otherwise known as Hannah Wilkes, and Courtney Wynn, whom you might know on Twitter as 40 Deuce Twits. These are Tennis World alumni, and so Skip is part of a treasured community. We've been talking tennis intermittently on the internet for over a decade, so Skip was able to help out Tennis with an Accent as our correspondent from London, and now we have him on our podcast. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Skip. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I appreciate being asked.
Yeah, so let's dive into the conversation, and starting with your on-site observations from the ATP Finals a month ago. You were in the nosebleed seats for one session. You were five rows behind the player's box for another session. So start by taking our listeners through the various particularities of each of those vantage points inside the O2 Arena and what you derived from each of those pairs of eyes at the ATP Finals. Tell us what it's like to see a match from those two positions.
Sure, happy to. Of the two positions being, we were literally in the last row, the highest row available at the O2 Arena. Between that and being five or six rows up from the court, when you're way up high like that, it most approximates the experience of seeing television on, seeing a tennis rather, on television. In that scenario, from that perspective, tennis is kind of reduced to a two-dimensional picture, where it's left, right, up and down. There's not much sense of speed, or there's less sense of spin. Certainly you're removed from the physicality of a match. But you do get to see the court as a whole and to understand the geometry of the court in a way that being really close doesn't permit you. The flip side of that, of course, is being really uptight. We were on our second session there, as you said, about five rows up and just a little bit towards the baseline from one of the players' seats next to the umpire. And there, while you don't get to understand the geometry of the court the same way, you do get to see the speed of the ball in a way that you never can understand it from row U, which was literally where we were. You don't get to understand the up-down of the ball, whether it's topspin or underspin. You don't really get to see the spin, the ability of the ball to drop with topspin, to bite with underspin. Those things are really muted when you're looking from up high, but they become very obvious when you're down low, as do some of the more subtleties, things like drop shots, finely angled balls, whether they're hit with topspin or underspin, achieve a certain nuance or greater detail than you could ever have by being as far away as we were in the nosebleed sections, as you say. So that's very much the most, or certainly the first level difference between them. I think secondarily, you become more aware of the players as individuals when you're that close. Not only, of course, can you see their facial expressions or potentially hear something that they may be saying to their box although we didn't experience any of that so much. But you realize that they are they have a certain stature. All of them, even the smallest of them, bring a certain sense of, again, physicality to the court. I have mentioned in the past that I did when I posted at tennisaccent.com that Jamie Murray comes across as being rather slight on television. I think certainly that's been my experience. But in fact, he's 6'3 and 185 pounds. It doesn't make him a worldwide wrestling specimen by any stretch of the imagination. I also commented that compared to he and Bruno Suarez, his partner, John Contenon and Piers were much more barrel chested. They're just bigger guys, really in thickness, but that none of them are small. And I found that to be the case even when seeing the WTA pros. They all come across as being larger and more, I don't know what the exact word is, but certainly none of them appear really slight. So I would say those are the really biggest examples of the difference between them. There's a difference in your personal experience when you're up high. You're so much more removed. You don't feel so much a part of it. Conversation comes more easily. When you're down close, you feel more constrained by the proximity to the court, and you're more overwhelmed by the atmosphere of silence and that you're not supposed to intrude by virtue of moving around or talking. And I would say that's the pretty much the best description I can give you between the two perches that we had.
Yeah, and in your writings, I touched on this a little bit, that in the upper bowl of a two-bowl arena, you know, a lower bowl that's more intimate, close to the court, and then the upper bowl, which is, you know, nosebleed seats, far removed, you commented on the notion of being given more leeway to carry on a conversation if you're sitting way up high, and that sort of thing should not really be policed all that much. Whereas if you're really close to the court, you know, it is a necessary part of tennis etiquette, or more precisely tennis spectator etiquette, to be quiet. But in the upper bowl, that there should be more freedom to carry on normal conversation. Explore that a little bit more for our listeners.
Yep, sure. You know, I can't pretend to have the equation for how to distinguish between what's so far away from the court that it's okay. I'll take the liberty of saying it's only up to me to bring up the question. And I don't feel a responsibility to have the answer. But at some level, if tennis truly wants to attract the more casual sports fan to the live experience, it seems to me we have to become, we being tennis or the tennis diehards, have to become more comfortable with the idea that in the upper reaches of various stadia, that moving about and talking is more acceptable. Clearly, it's what happens at football or NFL or basketball games, hockey games, ice hockey. And I'm not suggesting that we have a more raucous atmosphere down at court level. I kind of like the fact, personally, that tennis operates on a different standard. And as a tennis player, I can appreciate the fact that being able to hear how a ball is hit has an impact on how you're able to respond to it. But really, at some level, where we were at the nosebleed seats in row U, as I mentioned, the upper reaches of Ash, the upper reaches of Armstrong, I think that tennis really needs to figure out how to distinguish between those seats far removed from the action, where the players cannot, practically speaking, possibly be interrupted or distracted by movement or talking of spectators, and those seats, those spectators who are closer to the court, as we were in another session, as I said, five or six rows up, where clearly what's going on becomes more of an issue. Again, if tennis is really serious about attracting more casual sports fans, we have to at least look at what those sports fans are accustomed to in other situations in order to make it work. But again, I can't really tell you what that equation is, or what's far enough away, or what pitch of the stadium lends itself to that or doesn't. And it's not simply upper or lower. I'm fortunate enough to have been at center court at Wimbledon, and I can tell you that I can't see any place at Wimbledon where that would be okay. It's simply too intimate a setting. But there certainly are settings where it would be appropriate, as I see it.
So the design of center court really fosters intimacy and makes quiet more paramount. It's not so much the English crowds. It's more of the layout of the stadium. Is that kind of what you're getting at least to an extent?
I think that's probably true. I mean, it's a little bit hard to say what percentage of the crowd is British, you know, versus
sure
fundamentally tourists. But I would say that's generally true. It certainly was my experience when I was there in 97 when there was play on Middle Sunday. And of course, tickets can't be sold for Middle Sunday ahead of time because no one knows it's going to happen. And we went, my friend and I went to go queue up for Middle Sunday. He wasn't really interested. His name is Gene. Wasn't really interested in being there at 2 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, which I said was really necessary if we wanted to get in for this extra day. So we went there. We arrived maybe at 9 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock. And there were already 7,000 people in line at the park across the road from the club. But there was as fine an example of British politesse as you could possibly have. There was nobody managing the line, no one making sure that no one was cutting, jumping the queue, no one directing where the line was supposed to move to as people got added to it. And as Gene commented, were the same thing to happen in New York, they would have to bring out the riot police in order to stop murders and throat slashings from happening. So clearly there is a difference in what the atmosphere is or the ambiance from the attendees, but I can't tell you that they're all British. However, clearly the atmosphere at center court, it is just a very intimate setting. It's got this half roof over it. It's just smaller, more intimate. And I don't see where there's an upper or lower equation that would ever work there that would allow for basically unfettered conversation or movement in some part of it and not in others.
Sure.
Whether it's a crowd or not, I can't really say.
Yeah. Let's tackle this hypothetical, and a hypothetical that's not really it's not unmoored from reality. It almost certainly has some actual instances in the recent past. So some person in the upper bowl of a stadium, be it outdoor or indoor, I'm not sure it matters that much. Someone in the upper bowl of a stadium shouts out right in the middle of a service motion on, you know, a key point late in the third set of a close match. You know, is that something that the chair umpire needs to police, or is that something that tennis, organized tennis, should let slide just as part of the inevitable experience of having, you know, 17,000 different human beings spread out in a stadium? How should the sport deal with that, if at all?
Well, let's preface this by saying that you're asking me a question, but not saying in your opinion. So I'll respond by saying in my opinion.
I'm asking for your opinion. Yes.
I understand. I am all in favor of tennis accentuating its the places in which it varies from many, if not all, other sports. Actually, golf observes a fair bit of silence as well, because vive la différence. I mean, I don't think that everything has to be reduced to some very low common denominator in order for everything to work equally well. As someone who's been playing tennis for decades, I would say that at the very least, a shift to the idea that people can call out in the middle of points would take a generation to not become intrusive into a tennis match. I mean, everybody who's playing today, the youngest pro on tour, let's say, today is 16 or 17 years old, irrespective of which tour they're on. And they've played their whole life with this basic, for lack of a better term, tennis etiquette environment. So to all of a sudden change it tomorrow and say that it's okay to call out between a first and second serve or whatever example you want to use is always going to end up pulling the rug out or discombobulating your current pros. And it's going to take young juniors who start out playing at 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 to grow up with people yelling out between first and second serves before that doesn't occur. So I'm not saying it should happen, but any discussion about it happening has to take into account the fact, has to take into account that it's going to upset a lot of people for some good period of time. And a good example of that actually is playing lets on serves. All you need to do is go to a world team tennis match and see all the current pros who've grown up with lets on serves, even the college players, and see how just head scratching their reactions are to whiffing a serve that clips the net and falls in the box, because their first response is to not bother to return it. But of course, in world team tennis, they're supposed to. So it's not, there's a, we have to separate better or bad, or better or worse, as a value judgment from simply what everyone's accustomed to. In terms of what we should do, my opinion, I don't think that calling out between the first and second serve should ever be allowed. I think that it's great that it's not. I think that it lends itself to the crowd focusing on the action as well as the players themselves. So my vote would be, yes, the umpire's job is to try and police that. I don't want to conflate my suggestion that the upper tier groups should be able to walk and should be able to move about and talk while play is going on with people calling out intentionally in between points, or as a way of at least inserting themselves into the play, if not outright distracting the player.
Okay, let's get back to your experience of actual tennis inside the O2 Arena in London. And you remarked that from your courtside seat, you know, five rows back from the players' boxes, you could really feel and see the spin of the ball and the intent on a shot. And you attended, among other matches, a singles match involving Dominic Thiem and Kei Nishikori. And you remarked about how incredibly hard Thiem hit one of his backhands. And so I think a lot of our listeners would love to hear how you would deconstruct the Thiem backhand. And specifically from watching that shot, many will say that Thiem throws his body into his shots so much that he hits shots hard because of the sheer effort that he puts into his shots. But, you know, you, as someone who has coached tennis, you say it's not all about the raw effort. It's also about timing and hand-eye coordination and muscularity, various things coming together. So when you see Dominic Thiem hit a backhand really hard, and when you see him miss a lot of shots, because he was not calibrating his shots well most of the week. He was calibrating them well against Kay. That's the match during the week when things came together. But I think a lot of people are still wondering, why is it that Thiem has taken so long on faster hard courts to calibrate his ground strokes? What do you think he needs to get to that next level where he reaches an even higher level of consistency?
Well, from my very great distance from the tour and Thiem's life, my sense of it is not unlike that of many others. I mean, for one thing, he has very rather florid strokes, and they make it difficult for him to stand in close. And however much spin, radical topspin along the lines of Nadal or Thiem or many other players has changed the geometry of the court, allowing them to stand back further, et cetera, et cetera. The geometry still exists that if you're closer, more angles are available to you overall. And certainly the ability to rush the other player changes. If you take the ball 2 meters earlier, then effectively the ball comes back to the other player 4 meters faster, 2 meters towards you and 2 meters back. So long strokes mitigate against that. You need the time to create larger strokes. Part of it is also the mentality or the attitude that you take towards a point. If you see points as wars of attrition, and that's fundamentally what they are, then you are more willing to be somewhat less assertive and to rest your case more on a foundation of ultimate consistency. If you hit 37 balls, I'm going to hit 38. If you hit 38, I'm going to hit 37. Irrespective of how the balls are being hit, I'm simply going to get one more back than you. And I may try and push you into mistakes, but I'm not looking to push you into mistakes by virtue of my court positioning but rather by virtue of my assertiveness in the shots that I hit. So until he's able to move forwards, perhaps shorten his stroke and as much and as well change his attitude about it, I see that being a little bit difficult for him. You know, we've certainly seen in other players, and the most notable example of one who has adapted well is really Nadal, who's moved from being so from clearly proving that he's the greatest clay court player of all time with his record at the French to the fact that he's able to win Wimbledon. And while team, you know, got to the final at the French, no one's really suggested that he's made a big push at any of the faster court tournaments, much less grass. So there's still a ways to go there in that respect. I don't see that happening, you know, in the immediate future for him without that kind of change. Although he was standing in better at the O2. I'm not the first person to have commented that.
Okay. You have remarked to me in the past that the height of a player combined with the shape of ground strokes will affect the hitting zone and will also affect what I refer to as easy power. In other words, this notion of being able to generate maximum force on a ground stroke with, you know, more contained, less overtly obvious effort. So whereas Dominic Thiem, to me, seems as though he's throwing his body into a shot, someone like Tomas Berdych or also Juan Martín Del Potro seems to generate a more natural or fluid kind of power. So take listeners through this notion of how height doesn't just widen your hitting zone, but also affects the shape of the ball coming off the racket. How does height and how also does length, you know, wingspan factor into the shape of the ball? And perhaps you could also add, Skip, how you might teach different kinds of players how to hit a ball based on their wingspan.
Well, I think this is kind of an offshoot of a conversation you and I had earlier, that the physics of hitting a ball are such that somebody who's taller and has longer levers, as in longer arms, has the ability to create greater racket head speed at the extreme outside of their swing. And the example I think I used when we were talking was that Simona Halep, nobody really questions her technique, but she's never going to be able to hit the ball as hard as Juan Martín Del Potro, if for no other reason, and there are others, but if for no other reason than her arm length is simply shorter than his. And so if they both swing at the same speed at their shoulder, the greater length of his reach means that his racket is moving more quickly when it actually makes contact with the ball. And fast twitch muscles, actual muscle size, all those things are secondary to that basic fact of physics. So the height of a player, in as much as it affects what their wingspan is, makes it easier for them to create greater snap of the racket head speed, whatever you want to call it, at the outside edge of their wingspan. In terms of easy power, it's a helpful phrase in many ways, but I think it really takes into account it doesn't describe all the things that go into it. It's not just timing. It's not just strength. It's not just eye-hand coordination. I could have great timing. This is kind of a silly example. I could have great timing and great strength, but if I'm not able to make my racket touch the ball, it doesn't much matter. The flip side of that might be saying you could take somebody who's a great weightlifter, and that doesn't mean that just because they're strong, they're going to be able to hit the ball hard, much less keep it in. They clearly need timing, and they clearly need eye-hand coordination. So easy power is really a combination of all of those things, and that ability to just find the center of the strings on a greater, you know, to a greater degree more often than other players. You know, that magical combination is what we all search for if you're a tennis player. And it's an elixir that, you know, once you taste it a little bit, draws you in because you want more tastes of it. But few of us get to drink it as deeply as the pros, that's for sure.
Okay. We're going to go to Davis Cup in a little bit, but I want to wind up our ATP Finals discussion with a couple of things. First off, you saw it, the Roger Federer Alexander Zverev semifinal, and I know that you came away very impressed with Zverev in that match. So very simply, expand more on what you saw and what you appreciated in the evolution of Sasha Zverev.
Well, in some respects, what I saw in Zverev in that match was not so obvious until I understood what happened in the final, which I did not see. I was already, in transit on my way back home after that. So I didn't get to see it. I haven't sat down and watched a tape of it. I know what I've read about it, but I would say that his equanimity throughout the entire match against Federer, he didn't seem flustered. He seemed businesslike, nose to the grindstone. If he had a shaky moment, it didn't translate into a shaky section. I mean, that's not to say he played perfect tennis, because he didn't. But that's very much what I read about the final. Also, would not be inaccurate, I think, to call it rather Lendl-like. You know, especially number one for its own sake, for the sake of this description itself, and as well because, of course, Lendl is now his coach. It was just his approach to bringing to bear what he could in any given situation was workmanlike. This is what I have. Deal with it over and over and over again. I felt that in the match with Federer, watching it live, you never had the sense that Federer was ever really he broke at the beginning of the second set, and given his history, I don't think it would have been inaccurate to think, oh, here he comes, and the train is starting to roll and no one's really going to stop it. But in fact, Zverev broke right back, and that's kind of what I'm referring to. In the course of watching points, it was really Zverev who was setting the tone of the pace of courts, the pace of points, rather. I'm sorry, the weight of shot. Federer was responding, but it was like watching a fencing match where someone's always parrying and someone's always looking to score points and being on the aggressive side. The person parrying is being effective, but you don't really get the sense that they're getting their progress is two steps forwards, one step back. It's more like they're just maintaining, parity until such time as the other person scores points. Zverev really seemed very much to be the more brave player during the course of that match. And I think that's kind of what seemed to have come across, again, from reading about it. But in his final, he simply was more at home in the situation and more comfortable doing what he was going to do over and over again and confident that it was going to pay off in the end.
Okay. Final question about your experience in London at the O2 Arena.
Let me say one other thing about that.
Sure.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that at one break point, he also hit a serve to the outside in the ad court at 143. That's kind of a nice thing to have in your hip pocket. And I'm not suggesting that he can do it at will. There's nobody that can. But 143 to the outside, and by outside I mean, 3 feet up from the outside corner of the ad box, that's pretty spectacular. So I don't mean to suggest that he was simply robotic in the way he played, because he wasn't. Those things go a long way towards both shutting down an opponent and making you feel confident in what you're, in your ability to come through with the W at the end.
Okay, so to wrap up this portion of the conversation on your experience at the O2 Arena, there are some things that tourists, if they ever wanted to see a match or attend an event in the O2, would probably be interested in. And you have remarked in our back channel conversations that if you just have cash to make a transaction inside the O2, you might be in trouble. So elaborate on that for people who might be interested in going to the O2 in the future.
Yeah. You can definitely look, let's not mince words about it. The tournament's about making money. If you have cash, they're going to find a way to separate you from it. If you're giving them, have a chance. But it was interesting that there were situations where certain of the registers were set up so that they only were taking credit cards. You could be in line and you're waiting and you're placing the queue. You finally get up to your two or three spots from the register. And all of a sudden you hear them say, we're taking only credit cards here. If you want to go to cash, you need to go to register 7 or the right next door to my mate next door. And it was kind of odd. So a statement kind of about where modern culture is going, that cash is slowly dying. It's never, it's going to go, take a long time for it to be gone. But there were quite a few people who were more than ready to have their pint in their hand, who found that they had to change queues in order to get their beverage of choice if they wanted to get back to their seat in any time relatively soon.
Yeah. But, go ahead.
No. It wasn't a terrible thing. There was, I didn't see anybody get really discombobulated by it. But it was an odd statement about how commerce is moving forwards.
Sure. All right. So thank you for sharing that part of your experience covering the ATP Finals for us at Tennis with an Accent. So now let's go into Davis Cup. You know, it's still somewhat fresh in our mind. It's not too far in the past. You know, you love best of five tennis. I definitely know that much. But I also know that you're not in favor of keeping everything about Davis Cup exactly as it has always been, that there are some tweaks that you'd recommend. So it's kind of an in-between position, that you want to contain the core substance of Davis Cup, but that there are things that are worth changing. So take our listeners through that balance that you're trying to strike and some of the ways in which you think tennis could have perhaps found this better equilibrium instead of throwing out the Davis Cup entirely.
Sure. You know, I'll start off by saying, number one, that I'm old enough to remember the challenge round. So my perspective on this is not one that is recent, or the history of my perspective is not one that's recent. And it's really not so much that I thought that tennis had to change aspects of Davis Cup, but under the pressures that tennis, but more that under the pressures that tennis is feeling at the upper levels and regarding sponsorship and other commercial aspects, that some changes were probably inevitable, and that it's on that basis that I was okay with some of them. As somebody who grew up with tennis being a sport that was, if people knew about it, it was consigned to the outer reaches of the sporting environment. It was dismissed as not really very difficult and not tough and not major and just not consequential as a sport. I'm kind of okay with it being like that, but I realize it's my personal perspective on it. I mean, tennis, there's no doubt about it, tennis is one of the global sports in terms of its reach. The numbers are that there are far more people who play tennis than there are who play golf, for instance, one of the other great global sports. But in terms of its presence in the cultural zeitgeist of what are difficult sports, et cetera, it doesn't really reach the same level. And I'm kind of okay with that, but that's my personal opinion. I don't mind it being dismissed. At some level, it's a little bit like it's okay if nobody likes the things that I like, that they're just not smart enough to like it. But I realize that that's parochial, and that there are other concerns that motivate people to want to make changes in tennis or push tennis to have to make changes. So my feeling was that if Davis Cup needed to change, I saw that there were some changes that I thought could be made that would not affect the fundamental things that make Davis Cup great. I think one thing very easily would be could go to every 2 years. I just recently heard a great podcast with Mary Carrillo and John Wertheim at Wertheim's Beyond the Baseline podcast. And they talked about, Carrillo said, maybe one of the ways to increase interest in Davis Cup was to make it more rare, which is to say perhaps every 2 years. Now, there are others who say that the problem with that is that all you're really doing to great, you are more likely to have the income, as in make and cut into half, the income from Davis Cup from all the various federations than you are to do anything else. You might increase the interest, but you will not double the interest and maintain the income to all the various federations. if you go to every 2 years. I understand that, but I do understand the idea that you going to 2 years would make it easier to promote Davis Cup. Also make it easier, by the way, to keep it separate and apart from the Olympics years, which is part of the one of the challenges that Davis Cup finds. I am a big proponent of five set matches. I think tennis is has been forever a sport of the word is it's a marathon sport. It's a sport of endurance. What constitutes that endurance has changed over the years, but it is essentially or fundamentally an endurance sport. And I don't quite understand the reason why we should be making it shorter in terms of its structure. The scoring best of three versus best of five, simply because other things in tennis have changed, which I can touch on. I don't see anybody saying, geez, we really should be making, you know, marathons 13 miles rather than 26 plus miles because, geez, people aren't willing to watch marathons all the time, you know, from beginning to end. That part of it, I don't quite understand. I do understand that there are reasons, not the least of which is scheduling. At the four major tournaments, that when matches go to five in the early rounds, you have 128 on the men's and women's sides, a limited number of courts, five set matches where they open ended at the back end of in the fifth and deciding set makes scheduling a nightmare. I wouldn't want to have that job. I can understand that. So in terms of Davis Cup, where scheduling is less of an issue, but still something of an issue relative to television, the crowds who are attending, you know, going to some kind of a tiebreaker in the fifth set, that wouldn't I wouldn't lose any sleep over that were Davis Cup to accept that. Going to best of three, sorry, I kind of agree with Yannick Noah over that. That's not Davis Cup. Going to three, of course, we're talking about Davis Cup. So it's a three-man squad. Going to a three-man squad, sorry, I don't get that either. I think one of the things that's great about Davis Cup is the reverse singles aspect to it, both strategically or tactically on the part of the captain and the team in terms of the drama that gets built up into it. And I also think that it lends itself or makes possible two-man teams. You go to two singles matches and a doubles match and all gets done in a day, and all of a sudden you've just said to any small country that cannot field two quality singles players and separately a quality doubles team, that the odds of their being able to get into the world group are have been reduced to virtually nothing, to zero. You know, have there been a lot of them throughout Davis Cup's era? Certainly that won the cup? No. But Ivan Ljubicic and Mario Andrić did it. Tomas Berdych and Stepanek did it. And years ago, the Germans did it. Wilhelm Bongert and Christian Kunki did it. I mean, it's been done. And greatness is not defined only by whether or not you go all the way and win the final. You can get to a shorter round in the final and have greatness. And a very good example of that, actually, is just yesterday or today at tennis.com, Steve Tignor talked about one of the great matches of 2018, which is David Ferrer and Philip Kohlschreiber in the quarterfinals of the Davis Cup. It was a five-hour epic, and Steve pointed it out as just a stunning match. But it didn't have to happen in the final of Davis Cup in order for it to be great. So the idea of eliminating two-man teams, I think, is not just a matter of two-man teams won't win the cup, but countries that can only field a two-man team can no longer compete. So, sure.
So Skip, let me intervene with a more targeted question. You have talked about access as an item of significance, a topic of significance in terms of Davis Cup. And one thing that Saqib talked about with Mark Woodford, ITF board member and someone who is supportive of these new cups, the PK Cup and the ATP Cup, one was that the less wealthy tennis nations or really more federations, I'm talking really about the hierarchies of these nations, not the fans. The hierarchies of these nations, according to Woodford, and you can weigh in on this, are unwilling to finance and think that they are in a precarious financial situation in terms of putting forth the resources to host a Davis Cup tie under the longstanding home and away structure. And the incentive of the PK Cup is that you have one neutral site tournament, But of course, the trade-off for that financial gain, at least as far as Woodford sees it, you know, he for that for the less wealthy tennis nations, it's a benefit to not have to put forth the resources to host a tie. But the trade-off is that fans in those various nations can't now see their favorite players in the rounds of Davis Cup over the course of a calendar year. So where do you come down on this question of access and how fans across the world are now going to be deprived of Davis Cup tennis, you know, unless they go to the PK Cup in Madrid the next 2 years?
First of all, I'm touched by being asked to, throw my opinion into the ring relative to Mark Woodford's. It's not often that I get to, touch swords with one of the Woodies. But I think that there are a couple aspects to this question of access that come to mind. The first thing is that, and I'm not the first person to mention this, no one's really seen the money yet from the Cosmos Group or Gerard Piqué's investment banking group. And there's been a lot of talk about whether or not that money is actually there. I don't know what assurances the ITF was given that this money, at least the first few years, I don't expect the Cosmos to have set aside $3 billion in escrow and said, we'll pay this out. But certainly, and normally in a situation, in a business situation like this, someone has to say, all right, we have the first 3 years of this money already set aside. Here's our, here's our bona fides on this money that it's available. So there have been a number of questions raised across the tennis world questioning whether or not this money is actually there. So we need to be careful about comparing what we know to be true, i.e., here's the income that various associations have spent, received from ticket sales, et cetera, of Davis Cup versus something that is, at the moment, simply a hypothetical. This money is there, but where is it? That's number one. Number two is the question of access. The national associations, especially the smaller ones, would not have to host away matches or pay for a team to travel. But we also lose something. I mean, tennis in the United States has been played in Raleigh-Durham. It's been played in Portland. It's been played in San Diego. These are cities in the United States that never see professional men's tennis. And the same is true of so many other places around the globe over the course of the year. The match that I mentioned between Cole Schreiber and Ferrer, one of the reasons that it was so spectacular was because it was in Valencia, David Ferrer's home territory. Those things simply don't happen when it gets moved to this new format and it's all taking place, with the exception of the February matches, the February ties, that doesn't happen. So in terms of access, I'm not sure that we're increasing access. We're increasing the potential for somebody to go, but then as a third point, we're really talking about adults going, and adults probably of a certain economic demographic who are able to take the time to travel to this quote-unquote neutral city. I would question whether Madrid, the first year city chosen, is actually neutral, but to travel to a neutral city and spend some period of time there. I can't really see it as being an equal opportunity for 8 or 14-year-olds to travel with their parents to go and be out of school as it would be for the children in these smaller towns, admittedly around the world, to go and see a day's worth or even 3 days' worth of Davis Cup matches in these smaller areas. So the question of access is thrown into question there. We don't know, and to my knowledge, there have been no studies that were conducted to prove that people would actually travel, that they're going to go to some neutral site, which admittedly they're going to know ahead of time. There's an advantage to that. And they will know after February whether or not their team is going there. And whether they're going to stay for the whole week. They won't know if their team's going to make it through the week. Who's going to be left at the end of the week? Will there be home? How many hometown fans will actually be in the stands? Will the stands be filled? Will television pay the ad revenue or receive the ad revenue that will make it possible to pay the Cosmos what they need to see for this? I think there are a lot of questions there. We don't know what the agreement is, at least not to my knowledge, that would let Cosmos walk away if this program doesn't show the return on investment that they want to see. It's clearly built in there. No venture capitalists worth their salt would commit $3 billion without saying, hey, you know what, if I don't see a certain return on investment and ROI in the first X number of years, 2, 3, 4 years, that I can walk away. They clearly can, but we don't know what that is. And if it does happen, and if it turns out to be a bad idea, I don't want that to be the case, but I think it's quite likely. But if it does happen and they walk away, then what happens to Davis Cup or whatever we choose to call it? Lastly, and this is something that you and I hadn't touched on before, Matt, just to finish my rant, I understand the fact that the smaller countries need income. But I did a quick study, and I looked at what the published profit margins are, profit numbers are, not margins, margins are, for the four Big Four tournaments, Grand Slam tournaments. If the Big Four tournaments were to each tithe 10% of their profit, as I could best understand it, to the ITF for use for distribution to the, let's say it's to the associations in the groups in the of the Davis Cup and Fed Cup below the top tier, it would be $10 million a year. Now, I'm not saying that number is 100% accurate, but it's not hard to believe that it's entirely inaccurate either.
And if you're just like within 2 million of it, that's still a hefty chunk of change to be able to stage and resource and pay players and so on and so forth.
That's correct. And I'm not suggesting that the United States and France and Great Britain and Australia are responsible for maintaining tennis around the world. But I am saying that 10% of the profit margin that they show from these tournaments is not an unreasonable amount for them to contribute to the maintenance of tennis around the world that feeds the players, that is essentially the farm system for the players that come to their tournaments and then generate these funds for them. It's not a lot. It's 10%. 10%, somewhere around the neighborhood of $10 million. So I understand the idea of access, but I'm not sure that when you really get down to it, that it's there. And most notably, I think, is the idea that David Haggerty and the ITF, it's possible, and I'm saying it's possible because I cannot prove a negative. I cannot disprove a negative. I cannot say that they did no studies, but they trotted out zero studies about the feasibility of having people come to their festival of tennis for a week or 10 days somewhere and whether or not people would travel and what they would pay for it. And I think that discussing that question of access as a fact, given what we know, and I've also done the math on this based on the first week of Davis Cup in 2017, that in the first weekend of Davis Cup around the world, at the world tour level, at the world group level, there were something in the neighborhood of 145,000 people who attended matches over 3 days. And that may not be World Cup soccer level, but it's not chicken scratch either. And of course, it's, again, as I mentioned, in markets that otherwise aren't seeing pro tennis. End of rant.
Okay, I'm going to get into your formative experiences around tennis and more specifically your mentor and coach. But I want to wind up this segment of the conversation by giving you a choice of questions. You can answer one or the other. Heck, if you want to answer both, be my guest. But let me give you a choice of questions to answer. Question one is, 5 years from now, Laver Cup, PK Cup, ATP Cup, are any or all of those still going to be around? Question two, who or what is the most important person or organization or institution in tennis in terms of guiding the sport through this cluttered mess of cups, Laver, PK, ATP, in this next decade of uncertainty? What do you see in terms of the future of how these events are going to go and who really needs to either step up or perhaps step out of the way to make the right outcomes happen for men's tennis?
Well, I'm going to take the cheap way out and answer both questions, and I'll try and make it short. In 5 years, I can't say what's going to happen with PK Cup, what you refer to as PK Cup, the Davis Cup, or the ATP Cup, which by the way, I've not really looked at the what the structure is for the ATP Cup to a great degree. But I do have this to say about Laver Cup. It's impossible to believe that Laver Cup will not continue to be a success if it is otherwise left alone. If you consider that, if you answer the question, what is the hottest one day ticket in all of tennis? The answer, as I see it, is second Monday at Wimbledon. Fourth round matches at Wimbledon. Why? Because everybody's come through, and the odds of your seeing the distillation of the best players on the planet, admittedly at Wimbledon, is so great. So how can something like Laver Cup not be exciting when the players are all handpicked? Who would not want to go see the best players in the world all brought into one place, two teams of however many there were, eight players per team, all competing with each other? How could that not be great? It has to be great by definition, but it's not the same as competition as we know it, which is one reason why, however much they might disdain the idea that it's an exhibition, and I understand that at some level it's not, at another level, it really is. They're all there. I mean, Diego Schwartzman, as much as I may like his surname, Diego Schwartzman was not there because he earned his way in through some vetting process. Francis Tiafoe was there, and I think it was great for him. But what does it say about Francis Tiafoe that he played one match at the Laver Cup this year? It tells us that what really is going on is he's not the biggest draw, that the whole premise is based on a player's draw. And so you have a day where Federer plays both singles and doubles. Laver Cup, if it's otherwise left alone and not interfered with in some melding of all these various team situations, of course it's going to continue, because how could it not? It's a slam dunk. I do think I will put a little asterisk on that and say, I don't know what's going to happen to it once Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic are gone. I don't know that the Laver Cup can really continue without them. I think that they are unique in tennis's history, and I'm not sure that the players coming up behind them are ever going to fill their shoes in terms of star power. In terms of what group is most critical, was that the word you used?
Either a group or a person who you see as like a hinge point or pivot point,
okay,
figure in the next decade of tennis with all of these cups clashing.
The group that is the group that is the hinge point, the keystone for all of this, doesn't exist and should. And that group is a players' union that is not sponsoring tournaments a la the ATP or the WTA. Until there is a group that represents the players and the players' interests as they see it, you are not going to have that kind of group that's most critical to this. As much as I bemoan the situation with Davis Cup, as much as Yannick Noah, the French team, multiple other players are unhappy about the change in Davis Cup, the fact remains that the players didn't step up to the plate in this regard, if I can use a baseball metaphor. The players really had the opportunity to band together and say, we're not in favor of this and we will not support it. And they didn't. They individually voiced their opinions, and I praise them for that. And I'm happy for it, however wistfully I might do it, because, of course, we know that it didn't change anything. The ITF didn't poll the players, which maybe is an indication of how badly they need a union that represents their interests, absent the commercial interests of the ATP. But the group that is most likely to affect all of this doesn't exist yet, and that is that to me is a true players' union.
Okay. Final segment of our conversation. I'm loving the detail that you're bringing to the table here, Skip. Thank you so much. Let's now make this a little more personal. You have been coached by a man, and I was going to just call him Frank Brennan, but no, it's Frank X. Brennan Sr. I want to pay due respect. And he coached Billie Jean King. So that's a pretty big wow. So tell us more about Frank X. Brennan Sr., this person whose presence had to be very considerable in your life and in his orbit.
Sure. I'm happy to. So Mr. Brennan, I attended Mr. Brennan's tennis camp. It was one of the first tennis camps in the country. This was 69-70. He still was Billie Jean's coach. He was her first coach outside of California. She dedicated one of her Wimbledon wins to him early on. When he played tennis in high school in North Jersey, his record in high school was 75-0. 75 wins, no losses in high school. He was one of these people who you know, seem to find the middle of the strings, even if you blindfolded them and put the racket in the wrong hand and spun them around three times. He hit a heavy ball. He played with in the days when rackets came in light, medium, and heavy. And I'm going to shock some people who aren't familiar with this, but grips actually came up to a five. It was not just four and three eighths, four and a half, four and five eighths, four and three quarters, but there were fives. Mr. Brennan played with a five heavy, Jack Kramer. And he understood not only the technical aspects of it, but he was a great believer in the competitive aspect of what a player, competitor, brings to the court. When at his tennis camp, the students, the kids at camp, had lessons in the morning, and in the afternoon, matches were played. And there was a handicapping system so the lesser players could play against some of the better players. And Mr. Brennan would tell the kids, and later when I worked for him for years as a head coach, he would say to them, there are going to be kids who look good in the morning, who you're going to find in the afternoon are not the ones who win the tournaments, because there's somebody else who wants it more, who's willing to get one more ball back, who's willing to run a little harder, breathe a little deeper, and will just fight a little bit more to get it back. And really, that's one of the great things about tennis is that there's more than one way to, so to speak, to skin the cat, that you can have Serena Williams playing Agnieszka Radwanska, and in all other respects, you might think they're playing different games given how different their styles are. But it's the competitiveness that they both bring to the court, or both brought to the court, in Radwanska's case, that is really the thing that sets them apart. Mr. Brennan, the reason you make the comment that it's Mr. Brennan Sr., Frank X. Brennan Sr., his son, Frank Jr., was the coach for many years at Stanford, the women's coach at Stanford, very successful, inducted into the Collegiate Hall of Fame. His grandson, I believe, is actually now the assistant coach at Stanford, or was. He has a number of Mr. Brennan's children. I'm still in touch with them many years later. And he was a very big influence. He was one of the people who, or really the person, who taught me that one of the things you see on a tennis court is not just how somebody hits the ball, but who they are as a person. It becomes very obvious, both stylistically in terms of how they compete, that those things come through. So, yeah, it was very, still very, very formative. Absolutely.
What did Mr. Brennan teach you most centrally about how to coach and teach tennis to others? What were the tools and some of the central insights that he gave you that you can pass on to, you know, hundreds of tennis players over the years?
There's a lot. If I remembered everything that Mr. Brennan told me, or let me rephrase that. If I forgot half of what he told me, I still would know more than most people.
Start with the big ones.
Sure. I'll tell you the absolute biggest one. Well, the biggest one that Mr. Brennan got across to everybody was based on the idea, although he never expressed it this way, that tennis is fundamentally defensive. Baseball, basketball, football, hockey, you need to score a point. And you don't need to do that in tennis. You don't get 2 points for a winner and 1 point for not missing. You only get 1 point at a time. And so what Mr. Brennan taught us, without saying that, without being that specific about it, was what you do, whatever you can do to get the ball back one more time, you do it. If they're not looking and you have to kick it over, you kick it over. And of course, he wasn't really recommending that you cheat, but his point was, beauty is not what wins points. Getting the ball over one more time is what does it. And if you don't understand that, you can't be good. So you have to be willing to do whatever you can to get the ball back one more time. He was not, on the other hand, somebody who believed in long, drawn-out points. He was very dismissive of people who simply get the ball back with moon balls, which had become very popular, this was the era of wooden rackets, so it was a very different world. But especially on the WTA, there was a period of time when moon balls were, you know, really predominating through a lot of matches. Mr. Brennan was very disdainful of that. So I don't mean to suggest that he was recommending that you just simply be a backboard. But he did recognize, and he tried to get across to us, that getting the ball over was, in the end, last ball in play won the day. He also thought that tennis was very much like a street fight. I mean, he would tell you that the first person that lands a real solid blow in a street fight tends to be the person that wins. So he was definitely someone who saw serve and volley as the way to go. Again, the world was different then. Tennis was different. Racket head size, racket strings, all those things were very different. But he saw that, he felt that the nature of servant volley, where you somewhat take your fate into your own hands, was the way to play a tennis match. So I would say that. In terms of technique, more than that, you know, grips were very different by virtue of the equipment being different. There are certain techniques, technical things that were very different that Mr. Brennan, I'm sure, would have adapted to or worry with us today, given the modern equipment. But I will say that what he did basically say to us, and fundamentally, is that, look, if when you make contact with the ball, the racket is pointed in the direction that you want the ball to go, and you make contact with the ball ahead of your weight, and you more or less swing out towards your target, the ball's going to go where you want. May not land in, but it's going to go where you want. And I would say those things are still true. So he did teach us that, especially as coaches, that, you know, there are the fundamentals of any shot, and that they need to be the same between everybody, ball in the middle of the strings being the most basic, perhaps. And then there are the individual flourishes that make you recognize, let's say, Pete Sampras's serve from Rafael Nadal's in terms of their technique. There was plenty more, of course, as there would be with any coach in any sport, but those were pretty fundamental.
Sure. Winding down, I have two more questions. The next to last question is, okay, you've coached tennis for decades. If someone is interested in taking up tennis, you know, being a beginner, what is the first most elemental thing that you would say to them as their coach or their teacher?
Figure out a way to have fun while you're doing it. If you're not having fun, you're not going to come back a second time. You know, when I learned tennis as a kid, it was very structured, very formal. It was really designed in many ways accidentally to dampen youthful enthusiasm. Not long after I started, in the early 70s, or maybe it was even late 60s at that point, Arthur Ashe and Chris and Leif Beck here in the Philadelphia area, I don't remember who the other gentleman is, the name escapes me at the moment, founded the National Junior Tennis League, predominantly for kids in cities, really for kids in cities, not only underserved kids, but kids in the urban areas. And one of their basic premises was, we're not really going to discuss technique. We're not going to make them line up like in a parade review and all shadow stroke to the point of, you know, catching the racket at the end of a stroke. We're going to give them a little bit of help in terms of how to hit the ball, and then we're going to throw them into competition. And we're going to say, go out there and hit the ball however you want. Just get it over one more time than the other guy or gal on the other side of the net. And the competition is what really drove the early days of National Junior Tennis League. And it was had a, you know, tremendous amount of validity, that basically if you approach tennis as, or any sport, as some kind of aesthetic that you need to aspire to, and that's all that it is, then it becomes like being on the elliptical at the gym. It's not a game. It's not competition. If you treat it as competition, where the final score only says how much but not how, then how you hit the ball becomes really secondary to whether or not you manage to get it back over the net one more time and in, as is the case in tennis. So the first thing I would say to somebody is have fun and figure out a way to have fun. And the other thing is, about that is, it's hard to have fun in tennis when you're starting out, because if you don't make contact, which, as I taught my girls when they were little, contact is essential. They would parrot that back to me today. If you don't make contact, you know, hit, miss, 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 hit, miss, miss, and in between all of those, chase, chase, chase a ball, not a lot of fun. So figuring out a way to have fun at first is the primary thing.
Okay. And the last question of this conversation is that, you know, a lot of, if you ask a lot of Americans who aren't diehard tennis fans, they are more sports fans who happen to like tennis, at least at Wimbledon, the US Open. They would be casual. They might be diehard sports fans and casual tennis fans. If you were to ask that subset of Americans about tennis and its identity, they would probably say it's a genteel country club sport. But I know that, you know, some of your formative experiences in tennis came through the public courts in the United States. So there is this wondrous duality about tennis, that it can both be this country club game and a public court game and a city game, It has these two identities together. And you went to London with a couple of friends and you talked about old times and you talked, I'm sure, about tennis over the years. What have your friends and the people in your peer groups taught you about tennis? Not so much technique, but about the sport and why it's special. And what do you think the lessons are that tennis teaches, being able to touch into and reach into these different backgrounds and these different cultural identities?
Well, a couple things. And firstly, the first thing I'll do to answer your question would be to go back to Mr. Brennan, who would. So the way the structure was at the tennis camp was that every morning Mr. Brennan would give a talk. There'd be a stroke of the day that we would focus on in the morning. But he would leaven all these talks with stories and metaphors and lessons for the kids. Among them, just as an aside, would be, you have no right to tell your parents they can't come and watch your matches. I don't care. He would say, I don't care how uncomfortable you are, how nervous it makes you. If your parents pay for your lessons, they take you to practice, they drive you to these tournaments, they're entitled to watch. So there were life lessons that he was teaching us that I've always felt were part and parcel of being taught tennis or of any sport, really. I'm not familiar with teaching other sports, but I believe that that's all there as well. But one of the things that he did teach, and he did tell kids this, is if you are a good tennis player, you will be welcome all around the world. And I would say that both my life in tennis, my life has demonstrated that in many ways. And I've seen that for a multitude of my friends. In terms of the guys that I met in London this year, one of whom I first met while working for Mr. Brennan in 1971, and the other who I met while the two of us were both teaching for yet another fellow who I met originally teaching for Mr. Brennan in the early 70s when at his tennis camp in Oxford, England. One of the things I've learned from them, there are a couple things. First thing is relative to the tennis itself is, as I said before, there are many ways to skin a cat. The two friends I met with, Graham and Alan, play very different types of tennis, but they're both formidable club players. Alan probably better than Graham at some level when he was younger, but and that's a wonderful thing about tennis, that there's this great expression of individuality in the technique and in the manner at which one approaches a match. I'm sure that that's there in gymnastics, but I'm not sure that it's as readily apparent to the casual fan. I think one of the great things about tennis for the casual fan is that those things are really very obvious. And I'd go so far as to say that that's one of the things that fueled the Federer Nadal, high point of their rivalry in the early 2000s was that the public, even the casual fan, was so easily able to identify the differences between them. You didn't need to be a diehard tennis fan, much less a coach, to recognize the differences in the way they approach the game, how they hit the ball, how they approach the match, what their personas were made manifest in the way they played. And that was exciting. That was the same thing, to give you, for instance, between Navratilova and Everett. The contrast was there, and probably there with Sampras and Agassi as well. I mean, those are the obvious examples, but there are plenty of them. Beyond that, independent of how well one plays, anybody who's been involved in tennis really at pretty much any level, whether it's at the parks level or at the country club, can point to friendships that have existed on the tennis court, if not beyond the tennis court, just for years and years and years. And they're all bound up in tennis. I think that, the team sports that we all know about are great sports. They have wonderful traditions and deep meaning in many ways. They have meaning that transcend, wins and losses and trophies. But very few people play those sports once they get much past their mid-20s. And tennis is not that way. You can go and play tennis around the world. We know that there's a world seniors that they're playing the 90s. There's no soccer league for 90-year-olds. and so that is something that is really unique to tennis and makes it special and is to be cherished and developed, I think, and honored. And, you know, as corny as it sounds, you try and pass that on to somebody who's 12 or 10. And it means nothing to them then. And if they stray from tennis, it'll never mean anything to them. But if they stay with tennis, it'll start meaning something to them as they get older. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Well, I think it's been a wonderful thing to have you, Skip Schwartzman, on the Tennis with an Accent podcast. Skip, thank you for giving so much of your time. I want to tell our listeners that you can find Skip on Twitter at TennisSkip1515, TennisSkip1515. Of course, Skip had to put a tennis score into his Twitter handle where you can interact with him on this podcast and feel free to ask him any and all questions about tennis. So I hope this was wonderful for you, Skip, sharing your insights, sharing your opinions, sharing your experiences. If there's any closing remark that you'd like to make, feel free.
Well, the only closing remark I could say is just, you know, if people listen to this podcast, I hope they do. I hope they enjoy it. The next thing they should do is put down their phone or their computer or their headphones and go outside and try and find the middle of the strings with the ball. That's really what it's all about.
That's a lovely note on which to end. So I want to tell our listeners that you can listen to the Tennis with an Accent podcast on Google Play, Stitcher, RadioInfluence.com, which produces this podcast, and iTunes and Apple Podcasts, where we encourage you to subscribe, rate, and review, and to tell your friends to do the same. This is Matt Zemek signing off for the Tennis with an Accent podcast. We, and that means myself and Saqib Ali, will see you next week. So long.
This is a Jim Fannin Show quick fix on Radio Influence.
There are three trigger points that combine to raise stress levels this time of year. Number one, physical demands. You may be working longer hours to close out accounts, to do inventory, to finish, and as you're striving to reach or exceed whatever your annual goals are. And that's on a personal level. That's on a corporate level. Your kids are on a break from school. That's the good news. That's also stressful news. You're going to find that out real quickly, Seth, when your kid learns to walk and talk. There's other demands. Also, there's organizing travel. That can be traumatic. Yes, Amtrak's still safe, so go back on Amtrak. But it's still stressful. Travel with kids, with presents, and with millions of other people. Rushing to holiday parties. Commitments that I got to go. It's my boss is throwing a party. There's no option. Honey, we're going. I don't want to go. We got to go. And then you're throwing your own holiday gatherings, and you want to pull it off 100%. Well, that takes time. That takes planning. And then, obviously, shopping.
The Jim Fannin Show can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.